Welcome to Matters of Fact. I'm your host, Kay Skinny. Joining me today is a good friend of the show, the founder of the Imperfect Messenger Foundation and the author of the Blind Vision series, Mr. Curtis Greco. Curtis, how are you today?
I'm doing swell, Kenny. Always good to be with you and spend time with you talking about issues that the press largely ignores and see if we can't start to bring some clarity to some of these points. And again, like I said, it's always great to be with you.
Speaking of a topic that the press has kind of ignored, let's get into it. This topic hasn't seen that much light of day with all the other things that happened in the tax deal. In the recent tax deal, there's going to be a 2% cut in Social Security contributions per person. Now, depending on what source you use, they say Social Security will start paying more than it receives somewhere between 2017 and 2035. Now, with Social Security struggling as it is this decrease a good thing, and could this 2% decrease be the straw that breaks the figurative camel's back?
Well, what they've done with the tax deal in many different levels is, in effect, created yet just simply another stimulus package, a rather expensive stimulus package that could, when it's all said and done, push well over the $1 trillion mark because of not only these cuts, but how these cuts get funded. Because even if you reduce the Social Security tax by 2%, and I'll get more specific about that in a second, but even if you reduce that as far as the collection end of it from the employee base, what the tax deal did not do is address the actual benefit. Okay, so even though you're reducing your 2% your contribution from your it drops it down to approximately 4.7%, I believe, from the 6.7% contribution, the benefits structure that is implicit or designed or embedded within the Social Security package doesn't change. So what you are actually doing by creating this reduction in Social Security is, not only are you reducing the amount of revenue that's going to be contributed to the Social Security program, but you're also increasing on the back end the debt or the deficit or the negative, or what's also known as unfunded liability, because you are not changing the payout effects of the demands of the program benefits as described. So you're reducing the revenue, but you're actually creating just a larger component of unfunded, larger component of the unfunded portion of the program. So it's an awful attempt at stimulating the economy, because really, if we go back to the issue of what is Social Security, as far as from the taxpayer standpoint, when a person has a withholding in their paycheck, you and I, or a person who has withholdings in their paycheck, has a component that's called Social Security, and then there's Medicaid, Medicare, that's withheld from your paycheck. All they've done is taken that portion that is normally your contribution, reduced it by 2%. The idea being is that it's going to put more money in your paycheck, your net paycheck is going to be higher, and somehow magically this is going to suddenly stimulate the economy, or resuscitate, in effect act as some form of a defibrillator and create this magnificent economic response, which clearly it won't do it because there's other systemic problems that exist. But and then the other part of it is the employer's portion that most people never see. That's the matching component of Social Security and Medicaid that is paid for by that is funded by the employer. So when you look at Social Security in the form that they have created it, as far as this 2% tax reduction, the key point to be that I hope that is left with the listeners is that, in effect, what they've done is they've simply used an existing funding mechanism, an existing entitlement program, Social Security, to fund government stimulus entitlements through the illusion that by putting more money in the taxpayer's pocket, that somehow it's going to be an economic revitalizing component. It's going to be some form of magic elixir that's going to, you know, generate these responses, this economic response. But in fact, what it's done is just simply actually further poisoned the economic environment. But I think there's a greater point that the public needs to be considerate of regarding the Social Security and Medicaid. And it also relates to the Obamacare concept of nationalized health care, because I actually believe that over the horizon, what's going to happen with Social Security, which presently is at about $110 trillion of unfunded mandates, I actually think that what's going to happen is that Social Security is going to be targeted for a complete restructuring into some form of what will be thought of by the public. And I'm not sure yet how the government will pitch it, but it is possible that it will be seen as privatizing of Social Security. I don't have actually a problem with privatizing Social Security or personal investment or personal retirement accounts. I actually think it's a smart idea. I actually think it's a smart idea because anybody under the age of 50 is probably getting pretty clear that there is not going to be a Social Security retirement benefit for them into their retirement years. That ultimately what's going to happen is that Social Security will ultimately phase out because it, in effect, is an unsustainable, like the federal government's debt load and the national debt load. It is an economically unsustainable program as it has been used and as it has been managed. Because remember that whenever we talk about Social Security and how you'll hear in the press that Social Security is liquid through 2012 or Social Security is fully funded through 2012, what folks also always need to remember is those are just simply statistical interpretations based on the current ability the government has to collect taxes from the public through the payroll withholding, when in fact Social Security is not funded. In fact, there is no Social Security liquidity because what the government does is uses the funds collected in your paychecks from our paychecks to simply fund the government. And in effect, what exists in the Social Security Trust Fund is nothing but a series of IOUs. There is no money in Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare. Those programs are fully funded from the operating balances or operating processes of the U.S. Treasury. So without getting off on these subjects, let's just and I can certainly do it, but the Social Security program is very susceptible to the privatization concepts that I think you're going to see, and I think what's going to drive it is this belief that the private sector, code word for Wall Street, can use the funds or these illusory balances that you've accrued in your Social Security account, referenced by your individual Social Security number, that they can better invest it and make it more profitable and recover the unfunded components of Social Security by putting it into the financial markets, right? And in fact, all they're going to do is just create another economic boom for Wall Street that will shuffle funds through this menagerie that we call Wall Street and simply make billions and billions of dollars on transaction fees that will further line the pockets of this out-of-controlled mechanism we call Wall Street. I probably went a little too far into that than you may have wanted, but if the 2% Social Security concept right now, I think they've measured it at $187 billion, I think is what they said it would cost for just the Social Security portion of it. But in fact, the reality of it is a much bigger financial cost to the taxpayer, and I believe it's integral to a longer-range plan for attacking Social Security and implementing some form of redesign scenario that the government will use and sell to the public as a way to solve the Social Security problem.
As you said, the primary reason for this payroll cut to Social Security is to stimulate the economy. Some of the numbers that have been thrown out is a person that earns like $500,000 or $50,000 a year will get another $1,000 in his pocket, and a person making $100,000 will get $2,000. And the people who pass this believe that now the people will go out and spend this extra money, therefore stimulating the economy. But opponents say that the average person isn't even going to notice this extra amount of money. Where do you stand on that?
Well, and that's part of, you know, the joke of it and the fallacy that the government pitches in these types of programs. You're right. When you're most Americans now are struggling with various economic battles within their economic domain, you know, your household, right? When you spread out $1,000 over 12 months, okay, or actually maybe if you're paid every week or if you're paid every 2 weeks or if you're paid monthly, okay, you can break this $1,000 using your example of $50,000 income. On a weekly basis, you're talking $100, you know, you're talking, for some people, maybe $68. I mean, you know, it's an insignificant amount of money in the greater scheme of a much bigger problem, which is the economic degradation of the country. I'm known for making a comment about how government articulates its interests, and it sounds something like this. Government makes political responses to strategic problems it creates. So whenever you look at this idea of this tax plan, and if you look at what was in the tax plan, whether it was the Social Security 2% reduction, whether it was the ethanol fuel credits, the extension of various subsidies to different entities, the alternative fuels or alternative energy credits, and so on and so forth, what you really find is that these are all political responses. Okay, they are feeding the perceptions of the public that the government is doing something, when in reality, yes, the government is doing something. The question that really should be asked is, what is the result? So as you acutely point out, how much, when you're in a household of, you know, the average household of 2.3 children and a husband and wife or a single person that's living from paycheck to paycheck, running to and from the local pawn shop, trying to feed, clothe, and meet the cost of feeding and clothing and providing shelter, and they're running from paycheck to paycheck trying to subsidize this, that they're having, you know, folks that are carrying two and three and, you know, four jobs in a household to try to keep the lid on things. I mean, that money is going to go to feed themselves. That money is going to be going to help paying for their housing. I don't see how I don't get the connection between stimulating the economy. I think it's negligible at best. I think it's dubious on the part of the government to believe that somehow this is actually going to have an economic effect.
Now, the Obama administration says not to worry because this cut in Social Security is only temporary. It's 1 year, and supporters in Congress say that the Social Security Trust Fund won't lose any money because the government's going to replace the lost payroll with general revenue funds. But that money, the government doesn't really have that money. Is that correct?
That's right. It's
going to be another loan.
It's just going to be more debt. I mean, that's the thing that I think is largely I'm not quite certain whether the government doesn't know this, or the government doesn't care, or the government's so indifferent to the fact of the truth of what's taking place economically in the country that the public is largely unaware and cannot make the connections. I think there's probably a combination in all of it. I think that what we see in the government. And I think I, you know, I had an opportunity to talk with a staffer of a California senator recently, and we were engaging in some of these observations that I was making. They were reading my blogs, some of my articles, and so on. And I got the opportunity to ask this person about a specific position this particular senator was taking. And I was really kind of amazed by her response. And she said, you know, Curtis, just you're giving far too much credit to the knowledge base of senators and congressmen. Because a lot of these folks have no idea about the economy. They're receiving their information from panels, from entities and so-called experts that are feeding them information. She goes, you know, you shouldn't be really too surprised by that. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, years ago when I was working in the public accounting profession, I wrote briefs. I had three occasions where I actually wrote briefs relative to tax legislation that went I contributed to that went to the Senate Finance Committee and the banking committees. And so clearly, I understood this. But what I really came full circle in the discussion was the reality that if they are not knowledgeable about even the most basic fundamentals of economic fundamentals, and they are relying on information that is being generated externally or within the government enterprise, to me, I was thinking then that really certainly explains why you can have Wall Street bills like the Dodd-Frank or the Frank-Dodd bill, right? You can have programs that get tossed through the government that create Obamacare-type-esque legislations because no one is putting forth the qualitative effort to really study and dissect the causal relationship, that is, the unintended consequences of what some of these bills do. And I'll give you a perfect example, if I might digress for just a minute, the Obamacare. It's a noble idea to say that, you know, we need to provide health care for the public or a device for health care for the public. It's quite another thing to impose the financial burden on the public through the artifice we call government and burden others who are with the cost of it. But more importantly, look and see what's happening to the private insurance component of the national health care. In the last year, my personal health insurance has doubled in premium. I haven't used it more. I haven't gotten sick more. I haven't made any claims. I've done nothing but write checks for health care insurance. And I have a major medical plan. In other words, I don't fund incidental medical services. Mine's a major medical plan with a deductible of, I believe, $8,500. And so what's happened is the insurance companies, anticipating the greater expense which they are incurring that becomes unfunded by these new government programs that are being instituted as part of Obamacare, are doing exactly what Obama hoped it would do, and that was push insurance companies out of the private market because it's unsustainable, forcing the public, who is now going to be losing more and more of their options for private health care, into having no other choice but to go to the Obamacare concept, which is going to be what you're ultimately going to see as a Medicare-esque type national health care system. And where the insurance companies are going to do is they're just simply going to move in and take what now is they do with what's called Medicare supplement insurance. It's a type of insurance that seniors purchase to cover the components of health care cost that Medicaid doesn't cover. It's purely optional. So guess what will happen? Only the people who can afford to buy healthcare supplement policies will purchase them. And by no stretch of the imagination or coincidence, one should also probably resolve to the fact that those will probably be the healthier component of the population, right? So creating a segment of the healthcare industry that will become highly lucrative because they'll now be able to select who they will accept into their pool, and likewise, those will also become the healthier component of the population, which logically the insurance companies are only going to accept the ones that they can underwrite that are the lower risks, and the end result is going to have a further diversion in the quality of national health care in the United States. And, the public thinking, well, I like this idea of national health care, but because nobody's thinking it through and looking at the consequences, okay, what you now have is a complete departure from what the original intention of the public sentiment. You know, when they do these wonderful and polls, and they say, well, do you think we should restructure healthcare in the United States? Well, of course, the public at large is going to answer that question yes. It gets distorted into believing that it's now a mandate to have national healthcare, when in fact what it's doing is actually destroying. It's doing exactly what, to the healthcare system, what the idea of treaties back in the 80s when they were doing this, the WTO and the GATT treaties and the NAFTA and the CAFTA treaties, that gave rise to this belief that we're all going to become obscenely wealthy because we're now going to break down the barriers of international trade for the United States, and that we're going to now, you know, become this economic superpower. And in fact, what did it do? It basically licensed the complete exporting of the U.S. economic engine. And if the public knew at the time that this was 25 years later going to be the picture of America, they probably would not have wanted their senators to sign that treaty. So back to to close on the point of Social Security and this 2% reduction and this sort of valueless concept that the government has attempted to sell in this tax bill, really all it has done is, one, created another government stimulus package with an estimated cost at the moment. They pitched it as $857 billion. When you calculate the unfunded portions of Social Security and some of these tax credits that they've extended, and the fact that they are unfunded, and you tack them on to the actual budget costs because of the debt that's going to have to be assumed to pay for them, it's actually well over $1 trillion. It's about $1.27 trillion. So, I don't know. Economic stimulus, we remain to be seen. But I think it'll be similar to, you know, the 2009, the stimulus program that, you know, the government did, building bridges to nowhere and building crossing walks for tiger salamanders, and you know, revitalizing buildings in national healthcare, or correction, in national state parks, national park systems that nobody uses, and so on and so forth. So. That's a misguided government appealing to an impulse response to give the public a belief that something is being accomplished, when in fact it's simply window dressing with a very huge cost attached to it.
Emily Brandon, who wrote a piece for U.S. News' Money section entitled 12 Ways to Fix Social Security back in May, said that the government should increase worker and employment contributions by 1.1%, bringing the total to 7.3%. She said that alone would cause Social Security's projected deficit to be eliminated. Now, we're going the other way. Do you think that a raise or a rise in Social Security contributions would help fix the problem, or is that just added to the burden of more taxes?
Well, trying to control my tendency to wax long-winded, I have a couple questions that are more, you know, more just a query sort of a approach. But I find it interesting that whenever government fails, their first solution is to raise taxes. Number one. Number two, that concomitant with the idea of raising taxes, you never see any sort of margin of effort applied to correcting the systemic problem that exists. In effect, what you're doing is throwing good money after once good money that has now become bad money. Okay? In other words, you're funding failed practices and failed administrative policies, the greed and avarice that is embedded in the Social Security Administration. Four, to believe that by improving or increasing the withholding and further burdening the public with a mandate that is perfectly and purely unsustainable doesn't make sense. In other words, you're going to take current taxpayer base to fund a historical funding mandate. In other words, the money that's being withheld now is not going to store or bank money for the current workforce. Not at all. It's going to pay for the current funding or entitlement demands, which leads to the question of what is it going to become in 2025 when the next generation moves past retirement age, and the workforce is now even smaller, the economic engine of the United States is even worse off. How are you? What are you going to do then? What are you going to fund? How are you going to fund those mandates? How are you going to cure the unfunded liabilities of future generations when the declining numbers, when the statistics, when the projections clearly show that in the next 25 years, Social Security will actually have unfunded mandates closer to $250 trillion. So the question then goes back to, and say, that perhaps the public might want to think about, is why not fix the Social Security system's structure and form and address the systemic, the inherent problems that have and are systemic obstacles with the current concept. It's important to remember that Social Security is nothing more than a perpetual annuity funded by constant and perpetual contributions. As long as you control the payment structure and the accrual of those benefits, you can manage it. The problem is that the money that has been put into Social Security does not exist. It's been spent by the government. That's number one. Number two, Social Security, like many government entitlement programs, has been altered from its original design to not be a retirement supplement, but has actually become a full retirement benefit for most people. It has never been the intention. It was never the design. It has become a mathematically unsustainable program because the political artifice has used it as a funding, as both a funding mechanism for government programs, excluding, not including Social Security, by the way, and it has also used it as a political tool to court votes. And that's the problem, one of the many problems with Social Security. There is a way to deal with it. There is a way to address it, but it's going to require a complete departure from what the public has begun or has become accustomed to thinking is the role of government in socializing among many different components, but at least in this argument or discussion, socializing this concept of perpetual retirement. There's a huge, huge paradigm shift that needs to take place about, one, what is the role of government, and two, what is the role of government in retirement and benefits programs that exist that are basically exhausting the economic capacity of this country.
Much that I have read is saying that these congressmen and women or senators usually get a lot of input when it comes to Social Security, but after this tax deal passed, they said there hasn't been that much of a response by the public. Why is this flown under the radar so much? And do both sides, do the Democrats and the Republicans really want this cut?
I think that it's a great question because I think the public has become worn out on the subject. I think that the public has become becoming ever more adept at understanding that what we hear and see coming out of the Alphabet news releases and the various outlets that in effect are nothing more than the arm of the government media complex. You're being told what they want you to know. Okay, they are creating discussions that cause you to be distracted onto one topic or another, and consequently away from the more critical issues. So I think that your question is incredibly valid and acutely intuitive, and that is that, one, no, Congress, I think they're terrified. I think the government is terrified, on one end, terrified of addressing the Social Security problem, because they know that if they address Social Security, that means they'll have to address Medicaid and Medicare. They're inseparable. And if you address Medicaid and Medicare, that means that it exposes the structural flaws and of the national health care concept. Because, by the way, they're identical. Okay, these are identical programs. The machinery that they function within and about are no different from Social Security or Medicaid or Medicare. But there's a greater question, I also think, is that when you look at government programs in the United States, since the 40s. I'm perplexed. I'm amazed that, and I've studied this in writing the books and writing the Blind Vision series. I went back and I spent 7 months studying every government entitlement program since the 40s. And do you realize there is not one government program that has ever fulfilled its design, ever fulfilled its economic demand, and in every case exceeded its initial budget slash cost projections by no less than 200%, and many well over that. So that begs the question, when you have an entity that has proven itself incapable of administrating programs, why is it do we believe that anything that comes out of that enterprise can be successful? But I think there's also another interesting observation. I think it also proves the point about the design of Republican government. I think it also proves an interesting point regarding this idea of self-governance or the structure of what is the Constitution of the United States and its the genesis of the Constitution being the Declaration of Independence. And that's this one simple point. It was never designed, it was never intended that government, self-government, become the albatross that it is today. Because understanding the truth of it is this. It's not possible for government to do these things. Because when it attempts to become the conscience of a people, when it pretends to become the administrative intellect of the people, it automatically becomes exposed to the bias of those that now design and define what your conscience is. I'd like to think that I'd prefer those options being left to you, to me, and to the other 300 million Americans that are out there struggling from day to day, wondering what's happened to their country, wondering why you walk down the streets of different towns, why stores are closing, why business people are struggling with making payroll, where you have an increasing inability of the country to actually sustain itself without having to go offshore to accomplish it. Vital questions, simple observations, but they are in tune with some of these points that I believe are largely ignored, and I believe go directly to your question about, you know, why doesn't the government want to do anything about it? Fact of the matter is, government doesn't want to. Government only wants to do what benefits the government. Government, by nature, only does what it needs to do to perpetuate the belief that without them, you do not or cannot exist. Mencken had a great quote that I think is, you know, just an extraordinarily relevant to close this particular topic. Mencken was a social commentator from back in the 60s, and he said this, or actually early mid 50s. He said, "The urge to save humanity is almost always a false front for the urge to rule." Good words.
That is a very interesting quote. Now, you just said something. You said that government doesn't want to fix Social Security. You send me emails every once in a while called your hot topics, and one of them said, Social Security, why the government really want to fix it, hint, the answers hidden in Obamacare legislation. What do you mean by that?
Well, I teased on that a little bit in the earlier comment. Because government doesn't want to fix Social Security. And the reason is because if government addresses Social Security, that means they're going to have to explain where the funds go that are being collected out of Social Security. You and I think that it's 6.7%. It's actually more than that. It's actually, you have to pair up the other side of it. You have to pair up the employer contribution to it. So in actuality, what government's doing is getting almost 15 cents, $1, out of your gross paycheck, half of which from you, half of which from your employer. So you, not only are you paying your federal income tax, and all of the other withholdings that come out of your paychecks, but you're also paying 15%. Granted, I acknowledge that half of it is the employee and half is the employer. But think of the windfall. Think of the amount of money that comes in automatically from your paycheck every month to the government, and the government doesn't even have to call you for it. Why? Because it's been shifted, the collection process has been shifted to the employer, and their penalties are so punitive to the employer that they don't dare not send that money in. That's why you have withholdings. That's why they play with withholdings and create these illusions that somehow there's this tax windfall that's coming to you on your paycheck. You know, Obama tried desperately to perpetuate the jobs, the American job creation job stimulus deal, which was nothing more than a cut in the amount of federal withholding tax that was being pulled from your paycheck. It was $200, I think, is all it was. But that is exactly why. They do not want to mess with Social Security because to do so exposes them to several risks. Number one, the loss of the control of the revenue. Number two, it exposes the flaws in Medicaid and Medicare. Right now, approximately 61 cents of every dollar collected to fund Medicaid and Medicare cannot be properly accounted for. It's either going out in false claims, it's either going out in some sort of biased contract, health contract, management contract, and or even worse, it's being embedded in the administrative process of the system where doctors and pharmaceutical companies are getting 250 to 300% above market for pharmaceuticals and services being rendered. So it's an incredible boondoggle. So to expose the government to the flaws in these systems will automatically generate from the public a huge gasp that will wonder why is it they haven't done something with it sooner. So that's point three. It will also show why Obamacare is integral to what I mentioned earlier, which is the long-range plan is to, from the financial systems, is to find a way to give the public the immunity of thought to believe that Grandpa, this massive, magnificent, avuncular character, is going to magically appear and is going to feed, clothe, and shelter you for eternity, and somehow it's magically going to be paid for by government, you know, the rich, right? So this is going to go off and it's going to be sold to the public. I suspect it'll be very creatively done, but this whole magic theory of maintaining government's influence in the areas of retirement and in the area of this national health care, there's huge money in this. There's billions of trillions upon trillions of dollars in these health care and retirement programs. Another key one is the health care contracts that are brought into the state and federal programs for prisons. You know, no one ever asks this question. When an inmate is incarcerated, who pays for his health care? You do. There are cases, studies in all across the nation where people are actually getting arrested in order to spend time in jail so that much-needed surgeries are conducted and paid for by the taxpayer. I mean, nobody pays attention to stuff like this. But these are, on an annual basis, in the $650, $700 billion a year range, some of these health care contracts that are awarded by the federal government through these programs, through these government Medicaid, Social Security, and various health care entitlement programs that exist in the government. So then, let's conclude with this. You really think the government wants the public to know this? Probably not.
No.
This is why, and I'll bet you that a great majority of congressmen and senators haven't a clue this is actually happening. And this is why, there is this great fear and this great wonder. I mean, let's face it. Since 1972, the last major inquiry into Social Security, it was in the early 70s. I may have the date wrong or the year wrong, but it was in the early 70s. There was a big study done by the federal government. I think it was done by the GOA or GAO, and they knew that there was a great statement by it might have even been Arlen Specter who did it, but I'd have to go back and verify it. But the comment was, and I'll paraphrase it, but was this: clearly, Social Security program is a mathematically unsustainable program doomed to perpetual failure. Government's known it all along. Why do they not want to fix it? Probably because there's way too much money in it. Government's not willing to relinquish control of that level or that such a huge component of government, of the public sector. Remember, once freedom in any form is surrendered for safety, it is freedom lost. And no greater safety is ever gained. Benjamin Franklin said, I think as I recall it, he said, any man who's willing to surrender liberty for liberty for security deserves neither and will get none. And that's the reality of it.
I agree to some extent. That amount of money always gets raided. Social Security is one of the first things when we go to war. Where do they borrow the money from? Social Security. So they don't want to give up that amount of money. But overall, what do you think of this tax deal overall in terms of, I understand that you believe it's an unnecessary economic stimulus, but are there things in it that you do like?
I think that, you know, from our prior discussions, you know, I'm a believer in individual liberty. I'm a believer in the native intellect and intelligence of the human being. I've looked and studied history back, 2,000, 4,000 years, and I've noticed some interesting events throughout that time period, and that is the ability of human beings to do extraordinary things when all appears lost. I find human beings incredibly capable of resurrecting themselves from even their most significant failings. There's a great comment that Ted Kennedy Jr. made at his father, the late Senator Kennedy's funeral. He said, one of the things I learned from my father that I will prize is that he taught me that even our most profound failures are ultimately survivable. And I just think, you know, from a standpoint of the extraordinary nature of human beings, Case, I can't accept that failure is the only option available. I don't know if it makes me a complete fluffball in the head or what, but I look at human beings, I stand in front of crowds and organizations and luncheons and speaking commitments, and I read the comments that people make and the emails and the postings on Facebook and all those sorts of things. And I got to tell you, you will never win an argument with me that says something like this, that humans are doomed to fail. I just can't accept that. So when I look at government or tax deals and all that sort of stuff, as strange as it may seem, I make commentaries about them from the linear projection of what's possible and what our potential is and how we seem to bend far too often to interests and influences that really make the journey so much more difficult on us than it needs to be. So I'm not an anti-government man. I'm not an anti-Democrat or an anti-Republican. I don't hate senators or congressmen. I don't have this sort of potential or perpetual petulance towards the system. I'm not an anarchist. I am a person who looks at the linear projections based on what we do. I make a comparison to the greater potential that we have and how we could be doing better, and I make a judgment based on what I observe. And when I look at the tax code, which I do have to confess, as an expert in economics, because of my personal exposure to the business world and the fact that I have been doing this for 30 years, I have accumulated some amount of knowledge about what are the markers of success and what are the markers of failures. And when I look at the tax code, not only as it has evolved through this last tax deal nonsense, and I look at the tax code and the thousands of pages of the Internal Revenue Code, and I've got to ask myself in response to somebody who asks me the question, is this the best we can do? And you know what my answer is going to be? No. We're robbing our potential. In book one, I think it is Valor Given. No, what was it? It's We Hold These Truths. I have a quote that's in there that I wrote many years ago, and it dealt with an observation I made when I was dealing with some interrogatories relative to the failures in the savings and loan crisis. And it goes like this. It says, "We the people are forever labored by the unknown good intrusive government silences." We the people are forever labored by the unknown good intrusive government silences. In essence, what that says is when you let government outside of its cage, its nature is to further penetrate the artifices and the structures of all phases of human existence. And in allowing it to do that, we suspend, we halt, we stop, we prevent the good that would have occurred had we not allowed government to do it. That is, to interfere with the personal, with the individual sovereign rights of an individual. And the worst of it is, we don't even know it, that it happened. And I'll give you an example real quick. Jonas Salk, everybody knows what he did. Jonas Salk with polio vaccine, right? If today, with government application of government bureaucracies imposed on the process that he engaged in, there would never have been the success of that vaccine. Intrusive government silences. So when I look at the tax code, I don't, you know, there's so many components in the tax code. I mean, think about it. We actually give tax credits to corporations to make them successful. We take personal, individual tax revenues that are extracted out of the paychecks of the middle class, so-called middle class. I call it the productive class because I believe the middle class is what made this country's capabilities so profound and so profoundly successful. We're taking the money out of the middle class. We're taking the money out of the taxpayer, individual taxpayer, who has no vested interest, does not own stock, in private corporations, and gives those very corporations tax credits to become economically viable. Now, I got to ask you, does that make sense? Why would you subsidize a corporation on the back of a person that has no vested interest in their success by extorting money from that individual to give it to that enterprise? But we do it. We call them investment tax credits. In the last 40 years, the relationship towards tax revenue generation in this country has become completely inverse. In the 40s, corporations were responsible for 51% of the tax revenues generated by the U.S. Treasury. Individuals, about 11%. Today, it's a complete reverse. Individuals, around 50%, varies a little bit from year to year, but hovering right around 50%. Corporations, right around 10 to 11%. Does that make sense? We are taxing the sovereign labor and corporal form of the individual, but yet we're letting an inanimate object, a corporation, has no life, has no form, has no value but for the contributions of the individuals that make it and give it life. And we're allowing those entities to harbor trillions and trillions of dollars that should otherwise be reinvested back into the system through what I call a process of regenerative economics that could have prevented the devastation to cities like Erie, Pennsylvania, to Rochester, New York, to Youngstown, Ohio, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to my old hometown in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, in southwestern PA, Memphis, Tennessee, Knoxville, Tennessee, and the list goes on and on. And so when you look at the tax code and you ask a man like me about how I feel about the tax code and how I feel about how the Internal Revenue Code is used to become an extension of political intention, I got to tell you, I got problems with it. Because it's not a mechanism that is for the betterment and the perfection of the idea we call self-governance, but in fact it's used as a mechanism selectively to benefit everyone else but you. And I got a problem with it. Sorry, you hit a soft subject with me. You could tell I lit up a little bit there.
Hey, that's all right. You had to get your feelings out. We know your feelings about the middle or what you call the productive class. So how do you feel when the, quote, experts say that this class is sort of disappearing? They're either blending into the upper class or they're dropping into the lower class.
I would agree, but I would refine it by saying more of the middle class is dropping than ascending. Because the middle class, when you're in the middle class, so-called middle class, which ironically, you know, can really be people that are making $300 up to $500,000 a year, okay? You can still be in the middle class. You really do not escape the burdens of the tax code until you're in the income dregs in the plus $2.5 to $3 million a year in this country, all right? That, at that point, you have the diminishing effect of the tax code. Up to that point or below that point, you are kind of like that proverbial, you know, hare that's in the race with the turtle that's nearing the finish line, right? But you've got a rope that's tied to your hindquarters that is about an inch short of the finish line, okay? I mean, that's just where you're at. You're in almost in a perpetual indentured servitude. You make just enough to kind of have some of the nice things, so to speak, and maybe live in a little better house and maybe have an extra car and all these sorts of things. But for the large part and for the most part, you're always and only 6 to 10 months away from insolvency, in spite of the illusion of all this money that the public thinks that you're making, because of the burden of processes that create that goes into creating those types of incomes, okay? You know, there have been years where I've made incredible amounts of money on paper, but the reality of it is that, you know, it's taxable, but what you don't see is the amount of money it took of me to expend to create that. So on paper, it looks like you made a lot of money, but really all you've done is simply paid back what you spent to do it, right? Net of what the government takes in the chunk in the form of taxes, whether on a state level or on a federal level. So in the question is, you do need to have a middle class. In fact, you do need to have a productive middle class. I actually believe that in the way to resolve and really truly institute a direction that will be deliberate and specific in regenerating the economic environment of the United States, I frankly think that two things the government could do quite simply. Number one, eliminate tax on all levels for income, household incomes under 250, maybe even as high as 300,000. You know, the reality of it is if you run the numbers on those income levels, but you would also have to eliminate all the tax credits that are offered on those incomes, right? In other words, we have various tax credits in the United States right now that even if you don't have income, you can file a tax return and get money back. There's child care credits, there's renter's credits, there's college credits. There's all these credits one of the great scams that's going on in this country right now is the illegals in this country filing tax returns to get child care credits. They have no income that's being registered, but they're filing tax returns to get tax credits. It's just goofy. But, you know, it goes on and nobody pays attention to it. But you know, that's just one of the cheeky things that goes on. So I think that to conclude the comment about the issue, I think is to say that when we cogitate and we condense all of these topics that deal with the economy, the middle class, and the tax code, they're all interrelated. They all feed one another. I think that if you want to resolve the tax code issue, at least preliminarily, economically, you can use the tax code to do it. I talk about this in several of my talks. I say, you know, we can redesign the tax code to actually be economically functional. Government needs to exist, but it needs to exist within a cage, and you never let it out. You also need to pay for government. There has to be a way to do it. The Constitution is full of mechanisms that entitle the government to pay for itself. But yet we've extended into this albatross of becoming this global policeman that is spending approximately $2 to $3 billion a month just in maintaining field forces on these various excursions that the U.S. finds itself in, maintaining 500-plus military bases across the globe, and so on and so forth. And we wonder how it is that we're having the economic implosion that we're having. How do you fix it? You get money back. You know, you're never going to solve the economic problem in this country until you do two critical things. Fix the tax code, get money back into people's pockets by providing an environment, ensuring an environment where they can be productive. Right now, that's been evaporated. That's gone 30 years ago. And why do you take the tax burden away from the middle class below $300,000? Very simply. Number one, they shouldn't be paying taxes in the first place. Number one. Number two, you release the pent-up burden of economic vibrance by doing what economic vibrant economies do, and that is create an economic cycle. Productive employment, productive income generation, people spending money to sustain their income or their economic cycle, and you put money back into the economy. That is why the middle class was such an integral part of the U.S. success, and that was because the middle income or productive class was the economic engine that created this, what I call the native, and sustained what I call the native economy, and that is the native economy is this: demand in search of supply. Because why? At some point, when you're very wealthy, and you're producing $3 to $5 or $10 million a year, or you've got net liquid funds in the plus $5 million a year, unless you're a person of complete insatiable desires of all forms of debauchery, at some point you can only consume so much. Right, so you've got all of this income coming in, but you're not spending it. Right, so at some point, the income level of an individual gets so high that all they're doing is storing money because they can't spend it for the basics. Because every human has similar requirements: you want to feed yourself, you want housing, and you want a mode of transportation. I mean, at some point, you can only spend so much. Which leads me to another point, which sometime we'll talk about, and that is I think we need to address the massive amounts of revenues and funds that are not being taxed, that are escaping the tax burden that they should have. Right now we tax active income. That's the money you make when you're engaged in your employment. I'm suggesting that we no longer tax income under $300,000. That's active income. But there's all this passive income that's sitting out there, money sitting in these large and municipal bond funds and 501c3 corporate entities that are sitting there escaping the tax burden. I think we need to broaden the tax base. I think we actually need to expand types of monies that should be contributing to the environment, the economic environment that the United States is, that largely escapes contributing to. And I think that's why, if we look at the tax code and think about it intelligently, I actually think churches and all of these nonprofits, universities, et cetera, I think they all should be paying taxes. They persist off of the back of the public, don't they? So why should they escape paying their fair share of it? You know, tax on income in excess of their demands, their economic demands. So those are some of my thoughts on that. I mean, universities are utterly, for the most part, worthless at this point in U.S. history. They're housing basically ground. They're basically housing or waypoints for the so-called wannabe intellectual, but yet producing an abundant crop of graduates with no place to work. We're creating an educated class of unemployed. And, worst case, producing them with huge debt loads for student loans. I mean, we've got to be out of our minds. But again, all of this is supremely fixable.
I wasn't going to go this way, but let's get into the last subject you touched upon a little bit. We became, as a nation, sort of a nation that offers a lot of service jobs, but our manufacturing gone. We still have all these people who go to college, and then they get out, and now these jobs aren't there. So do we need to, in turn, change what we're teaching kids? Should we shift back? I mean, not should we. How do we shift to math and science and manufacturing and things like that?
Well, I think the education process should be looked at in two distinctly different venues or frames of thought. I think what we need to do is understand that education is the mechanism whereby a person lifts themselves out of poverty. So I believe, as Thomas Jefferson said, that and he was dead right, is that we need to have a nation that has a foundation of intellect. We need to teach people how to think. We need to teach people how to act intellectually and intellectually relevant. So mathematics, literature, science, logic, critical thinking, I believe should be a foundation of our national economic decorum. On the level of education that moves people into productive periods of their life, I think we should apply the concept of native economy, demand in search of supply. Why would, you know, today in this country, if we wanted to build a new space shuttle, do you know we can't? We no longer possess the technological capability to produce a space shuttle. Okay, look at Boeing, for example. A great majority of Boeing's components for a Boeing aircraft are actually not made here in the United States. They're sourced from almost, I think, 30 different countries. Wing spars, I believe, come from China. I think the landing gear comes from Israel. I mean, I forget exactly. There's some interesting information on Boeing parts procurement that folks might find interesting. Forgive me if I reference points in error, but the countries are relevant. So what happens in the education process is that if you want to go to MIT or if you want to go to some college and you want to get a liberal arts education in basket weaving or, you know, literature or history, all of which, you know, there is value there, okay? But if you're going to come out and expect to have a vibrant economic future, and instead of becoming a perpetual student and go off and, you know, yet another attorney or, you know, a PhD in clinical psychology, providing treatment to your fellow clinicians, great. But if you're looking at it from a standpoint of waging war against the economic blight, then I think that what we need to do is start taking a native economy approach. That is, demand in search of supply. In other words, we need to be developing a curriculum of thought in education that coaches, counsels, and prepares students for an economic future. Clearly, we're not doing that. And we're producing these environments where we're coming out, like as I said in the earlier comment, we're producing an abundant crop of students coming out of the universities with no place to go, with no functional employment. I've got so many people that I've talked with in the last couple of years where they're coming out with, you know, $65,000, $70,000 in student debt, and they're working at Starbucks, for goodness sake. So I think we have two critical flaws, all of which are all related. Number one, because we have exported our economic engine into this illusion we call globalism, which, by the way, never existed. It was created, okay? And it was not created because it was necessary. It was created because it was an economic opportunity for financial interests. So we no longer have this economic environment. We're going to have to get serious about regenerating an economic engine in the United States. Two, because it relates to the education system, you need to also tie in the education system to be educating and producing at the second or tertiary level of education people who are creative in thought, who can exercise the processes necessary to progenerate economic creativity and economic function. We need to focus on producing and strategically targeting areas of economic evolution. and focus education on that level. We don't need any. We don't need more attorneys. You know, right now the U.S. I'm going to give you an example of, here on the West Coast, Cal Poly, and I probably shouldn't say that, but I'm going to. My own son, incredibly, did very well in high school, tops in his class. Normally would have wanted to go to Cal Poly. Had incredibly high scores in his SATs, entrance exams, and all that sort of stuff. Could not get into Cal Poly. Later, I find out that Cal Poly's agenda is to prefer to take foreign students because the university can collect more fees from a non-domestic student. And when I say foreign, that's not only foreign, that's any student outside of the domain of California. So I'm a taxpayer of California. I'm paying for these universities, and my own son can't gain entrance to them. Doesn't make sense to me. But this is the life of in the United States. This is the life that we all face over the horizon in a corporate structure. And by the way, universities are very much corporate structures because of their boards, their governing board of the board of governors, and private and government itself is a is certainly no different than any other publicly traded corporation. We have influence beyond their ability to handle, and consequently subject to indiscriminate bias. And the role of government, well, let me put it this way. When the created becomes and to believe it is supreme to the creator, that's when you have totalitarianism. And that's what you have. You have the government who believes it is supreme to the people who created it. When you have an entity that believes it to be omniscient and omnipotent, who checks it? When the Supreme Court makes a bad decision, the U.S. Supreme Court makes a poor decision, which it has done quite frequently, who overturns the Supreme Court? In the United States, there's only one mechanism that allows you to do that, and that's the states. So next time we talk, we should talk about that. That's a concept called nullification that Thomas Jefferson and people, when you get the chance, whose listenership should do some quick study on the Missouri Compromise. And you'll read about this concept called nullification and the power that the states have. It is the ultimate supreme power that remains to the individuals, to the people of this country. And it comes to, it is perfected and protected through the 10th Amendment of the Constitution that ultimately throws it back and it says, you know, basically those things not enumerated herein are left to the states or to the people themselves. And that's a great topic itself, too. I mean, it's more on the history end. But anyways, Casey, I hope I answered your question. You know, I love the topics because I see so much hope and so much the potency and the power of our people, of our fellow Americans, to rally together. This is not a distinction of Democrat and Republican, and one day we're going to gut that. We're all going to look at each other and smack each other on the forehead and go, duh. That is not Democrat. It's not Republican. America is not a Democrat or a Republican entity. It is on its own, its identity, American. And we are a people who, for whatever reason, our own motives, just like the founding fathers who signed the Declaration of Independence, well, they were all of different minds and sovereign individuals, but they did one supreme act that has forever and will forever define our destiny, and that is this. They converged. Though they were of different minds, they converged upon a common ideal. And that's what gave you and me this country. And we have a duty, this nation, each of us individually, have a duty to remember the sovereign links to the Declaration of Independence and our form of government and why it succeeded to the points that it has and why it's important for us to carry the ball over the next goalpost or over the next, you know, the next goal line. We can't go back. We, you know, this has to happen. We have to do this. There is no going back. You cannot go back and revisit the Dark Ages to learn you didn't want to do that. We already know these things, and I believe we can do it. And that's why I'm so grateful for you. I mean, I'm so grateful, and your audience and your listenerships and your station really needs to know how extraordinary a man you are. And we have off-tape discussions, and I'm always just completely infatuated with your acuity and your sensitivity to these issues. And I'm grateful that you, through your program, are able to disseminate some of these dialogues. I think you're sui generis. I think you're out there doing a country's work through your show, and I really do hope that you get ever more and ever broader exposure in your efforts to have these types of dialogues. And I got to tell you, pal, I'm grateful for it.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your knowledge and your 30 years of experience. As always, we touched on a myriad of topics. If you want more Curtis Greco, go to TheImperfectMessenger.com or check out his book series, The Blind Vision Series, available wherever good books are sold. Curtis, thank you very much for joining me. As always, I appreciate it very much. It's great to get the word out there, and you have a happy new year.
Same to you, Case. All the blessings into you and yours, and, of course, your listeners. I'm grateful. Thank you.